Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Dr. Dementia Show because we have, from the University of Kentucky, with the Department of Neurology and also the UK Sanders Brown Center on Aging, and a true Alzheimer's disease expert, Dr. Greg Jaka. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me on tonight.
Yeah, and speaking of thanks, I've got, unfortunately, we still have my co-medical host from the University of Kentucky, the service owner for telephony, to explain to us about, once again, in his uncopyable fashion, how you get to us on the interweb from UK, Rick Phillips. Hi, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know, you can get the audio of the shows at wmky.org. They're there. You can listen to them. They're in MP3 format. We keep 8 or 10 shows out there, just enough to keep you busy. It makes for a great Saturday. After the show ends Saturday morning at 9 a.m., just go to the website. Listen to it for the rest of the day. There's plenty of stuff there to listen to. What, Tony? Don't you agree with me?
It just sounds like a terrible Saturday. I mean, honestly, listening to hours of health.
Wait a minute. Please. These individuals woke up this morning, and now they're starting their day with us, and that's what you're saying?
Yeah.
Don't listen to us anymore today?
Hopefully they'll graduate to something a little bit more, entertaining.
Anyway, audio of the shows, WMKY.org. Sometimes we say WMKY.org. If you want to participate in Health Matters, go to Facebook.com/HM Radio Show or do a search for Health Matters Radio Show. There you'll find a page about Health Matters. Certainly, we hope you like us. We hope you follow us. You can leave comments. You can monitor Tony's feedback. There's all kinds of things you can do to interact with us. We put up research that we bring on to the show. Some news goes up on there that doesn't make it on the show. So, hey, for all you listeners out there, you can actually hear more about Health Matters by going to Facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Special thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. A couple of announcements here before we get to the sponsor. First of all, Greg, I know is near and dear to your heart, Mary Horsley at Moorhead has her annual Turkey Trot. That is a 5K walk run, and that is November 2nd. There will be the Turkey Trot here starting at the Share Building here in Moorhead and walking around downtown Moorhead. My wife and I, we don't run, but we'll be participating. And if you want to have our second annual Walk with a Nerd program, by all means, show up at the starting
walk
line.
Walk with a turkey. They're not nerds. They're turkeys.
Well, we will be on the outer edge, the ones that are incessantly talking about boring topics. If you want to.
I know
to,
what it is. You're just jealous because you've yet to make it to the power geek status.
Well,
you're just
yeah.
a plain old nerd.
Well, I don't think anybody's going to come and walk with me, but I would be pleasantly surprised, Rick, if you came and walked the Turkey Trot November 2nd.
Yeah, one of these days, we're going to have to work on getting you up to power nerd level.
All right, fair enough. Second announcement. Speaking of power nerds, our good friend at UK, Rob Spring, has received a grant to do diabetic eye screenings at 11:30 at the Share Building here in Moorhead. They will be explaining it. They will be demonstrating on September 30, and that's at 11:30 at the Share Building. It's an exciting thing because they're using the telemedicine technology. They have a camera, and they're actually going to do diabetic eye screenings with this camera, so you don't have to travel across the state, sit in an ophthalmologist's office. You can get this done at your local physician via camera and transmitted via the airwaves.
I'm sure glad you don't have to do that at home because I'm not sure I could dilate my own eyes.
Yeah. Well, that's the nice thing about it. This camera, apparently, it's just a quick photo and done, and you don't have to wait in line in the office. You can actually get that done at your primary care physician to be piloted at St. Clair's outpatient clinics and some other areas around the region. So that will be coming up on September 30 at the Share Building 1130. Our sponsor for today's show, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease is Alzheimer's disease. We have our top 10 Alzheimer's facts. Remember the Alzheimer's disease motto. Alzheimer's disease, what is that motto again? So our first five fun facts. First of all, fun fact number one, Alzheimer's disease first identified more than 100 years ago. Dr. Aloysius Alzheimer noted changes in the brain tissue of a woman who had an unusual mental illness. After she died, he examined her brain. He found clumps that we now call amyloid plaques. He found tangled bundles of fibers, now called neurofibrillary tangles. And Greg, I think still today, these two findings are some of the key findings of the brains of people with Alzheimer's.
That's exactly correct. We still look at brain tissue for these changes in the brain using actually identical stains to those used by Alzheimer himself over 100 years ago.
So some progress since that time, but that's where it all began. Fun fact number two, Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the American adults. It affects more than 5 million Americans, more than 8 million people worldwide. Fun fact number three, according to the U.S. Alzheimer's Association, Kentucky had 80,000 people with Alzheimer's disease in 2010. Greg, I suspect you saw about three quarters of them in your vast teleneurology clinic.
We see as many as need to be seen, as many as we possibly can, Tony.
And you have locations, you have these video clinics all over the state, right?
That's right. Very much like the diabetic eye screening, there are a large number of health centers that are able to connect with us for the latest state-of-the-art evaluation of memory and thinking problems.
Fun fact number four, according to the U.S. Alzheimer's Association, 1 in 8 people age 65 and older, and nearly 1 in 2 people over age 85 have Alzheimer's disease. Now, it looks like, Greg, I know there's been this continuing, I think we'll talk later in the show about this, this continuing back and forth about whether this is normal aging or not, but certainly it is a very common part of the life of people in their upper 80s and in their 90s.
That's exactly correct. We see a high prevalence of this, not just in terms of the clinical symptoms of memory and thinking loss, but actually when we look at brain tissue, biological markers, imaging in folks over the age of 85, we'll see the Alzheimer's disease there. But again, I think it's just part of the story.
And fun fact number five, age is the primary risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. The number of cases of Alzheimer's doubles every 5 years for people over age 65. That's our sponsor, the Top 10 Fun Facts About Alzheimer's Disease, the Disease of the Month Club, this month's disease, obviously, Alzheimer's disease. Now, Greg has been on the show before, and first of all, I admire the heck out of this guy, and then secondly, I regard him as a friend. Came here from, I guess you were at the Mayo Clinic before you were here.
That's correct.
But also trained at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and you were a MD, PhD as a part of their, it's called Medical Scientist Training Program, MSTP program. People who get into this, generally, Rick, are smarter than either one of us put together.
No argument there.
Yeah.
Either that or just afraid of getting out of school and getting a job, Tony.
Yeah.
we're afraid of that, too.
Yeah, that's the thing. You can't hide behind that because you got some of the. But at any rate, a brilliant guy came here. Now, my understanding in talking to you before is that I think there was a certain person who really was influential in bringing you into Kentucky.
Yeah, that's right. The late William Marksberry, Bill Marksberry, was really the founding father of the Center on Aging and really the aging thrust of what we're doing at the University of Kentucky. One of the original pioneers in the field whose work really was seminal in dismantling the hypothesis that your aluminum pots and pans were creating Alzheimer's disease. Clearly, that's not the case. And Bill really was an icon, a true Kentucky gentleman. I admired him very much and had the opportunity to work with him several years here before he eventually passed.
Now, I know you came because of his reputation and the work that he had done. Was it a surprise to you? I just actually this morning was looking at rates of Alzheimer's disease in preparation for the program, and I know that Kentucky has both risk factors and rates that are above national averages for our population. Were you surprised at the amount of work you needed to do here?
You know, Tony, now that I'm here, I recognize that Alzheimer's is a problem everywhere, but here especially, the risk factors for Alzheimer's disease are really abundant in folks out there. They really need help. We have very few centers, very few folks across the state that are willing or able at this point to tackle this problem. There's so much demand and need that I've really devoted my life at present to this sole purpose of helping those in Kentucky and in the region really battle memory problems and achieve what I'd like for everyone, which is successful brain aging.
Well, let me ask you about that. This was from the New York Times back in July. They were looking at analysis by the RAND Corporation. If dementia rates remain steady, the total number of people with dementias of various type would double in the next 30 years because of aging baby boomers. Now, British researchers at Cambridge have said, well, not so fast. The rates are actually dropping in England. Do you think the Alzheimer's rates are dropping? Do you think that we've somehow crested and rates will fall off, or do you think they're still rising?
Tony, that's an excellent question, and it's always difficult when we come to predicting what the future population risk is. It's kind of like a bunch of scientists peering into a crystal ball. One of my favorite studies to quote was one that was done in 1990, and it was estimating that by the year 2020, we would hit 5 million people in the United States with dementia. And instead, we hit that mark by 2010. Whoops. That goes to show just how far off some of these surveys can be. Now, the study in England, really what it showed was not that the rates of dementia were remarkably diminished, but the rates of moderate to severe dementia. And I think that that may be reflective of all that we have to offer, all that people can do individually in improving lifestyle and reducing risk factors, as well as using some of the treatments that are available nowadays to try to slow the process down. I think that Alzheimer's is still there, but I think we're battling its symptoms quite effectively.
Speaking of risk factors, talk about the grant that you've got to modify risk factors. What is that about?
So this is in what I think is just a wonderful project, and it really dates back to the late 1800s, for all intents and purposes, not my personal grant, but this field of thought anyway. Years before Alzheimer's described these plaques and tangles in the brain, he actually described vascular disease in the brain with another doctor known as Binswanger. And this was really the first description of a dementing process. We discarded that, of course, with the advent of Alzheimer's disease. And then eventually we moved into what was called hardening of the arteries. And hardening of the arteries, of course, we recognize represented some sort of vascular injury. The pendulum swings again. We're back in Alzheimer's disease. And I think from recent work that we've done, looking at the National Brain Bank, and there is a National Brain Bank for Alzheimer's disease with several thousand folks that have donated brain tissue in that, we do indeed find Alzheimer's disease pathology present in 50% of folks over the age of 65. But not all those folks have memory problems. What's even more worrisome is in that same brain bank, we find significant vascular disease in the brain in 80% of folks that age. That's a big problem. Here in Kentucky, using the telemedicine system to reach out and look across the state, what we find in Kentucky is that the prevalence, the number of people with those risk factors, is much, much higher in urban and suburban areas than it is in the major cities, and much, much higher than it is elsewhere in the nation. One of the reasons why we live in the stroke belt here. We're really picking this up and beginning to study this because we think that in the same way that we're impacting heart disease, we can reduce dementia. We can reduce the memory and thinking problems that our aging population may experience.
So you think we need to reach out to rural Kentucky and try to address these risk factors, which heart disease and Alzheimer's disease share in common?
Absolutely. I think that when you're studying a disease, you have to go to where the disease is hurting people most, to where the disease is prevalent. And when we look in Kentucky, it is some of the less well-served populations throughout Kentucky that are at greatest risk for dementia. They're the people that are in greatest need of help and the most important ones for us to be studying, for us to be helping out of this mess that we've gotten ourselves into.
Speaking of underserved, you should serve yourself up a fine snack of a healthy food. I don't know what it is. Carrots, do you think, Rick? Or
that just makes you see better.
Some type of brain food anyway. And stay tuned for our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is a second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Dr. Dementia Show with Dr. Greg Jikin, again, the professor of neurology and also with the Sanders Brown Center on Aging at the University of Kentucky. Welcome back, Greg.
Thanks, Tony.
Can we give him a title of wizard?
Rick, after that first segment, I feel like
I'm sitting next to the wizard.
Yeah, well, you know how I feel about this. I mean, there are people, and I know, Greg especially, you felt this way about Marksberry. I feel this way about you. Being in the same room with a person who has, if you understand Dr. Jikin's clinical approach, his encyclopedic knowledge of neurology and dementias, I am right now just trying to contain.
I've already forgotten most of the stuff he said.
I understand. We'll try to keep going, though. Our sponsor for the second time, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease, obviously, Alzheimer's disease. Motto, Alzheimer's disease. What is that motto again? We talked about our top 10 fun facts about Alzheimer's disease. We are at number 6. Remember number 5, Rick.
But we're talking about these Alzheimer's things. Shouldn't you go over them again?
Yeah, we will, but we'll catch that in our last fractional portion.
Okay.
But number 5, we talked about by age 85, almost half of all people are afflicted with Alzheimer's disease. And this, again, from the textbooks, Greg, it is exceptional. Their word, it is exceptional for Alzheimer's disease to occur before age 60. Is there an age where someone says, oh, I've got this 40-year-old, this 30-year-old, this 25-year-old who has Alzheimer's disease, when you say, no, it doesn't happen at that age? Or is this something that in rare cases could happen at any age?
No, I think that Alzheimer's can occur, and current criteria suggests that the onset should occur at least after age 40. But even in some instances, we will see folks come down with Alzheimer's in their 30s. Typically, when we see early age onset in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, there is a strong familial or genetic link, meaning if it runs in someone's family, their mom, their dad, their grandparents came down with Alzheimer's also in their 40s or 50s, we usually don't blink. When there's an absence of family history and someone that young comes down with a dementia, problems with their memory and thinking, then we really do have to look twice, Tony.
Okay.
Well, now, what I'm curious about is what constitutes a legitimate dementia? Because I was talking to my daughter 2 or 3 days ago, and she said, Dad, your short-term memory is gone. You need to see somebody.
Okay. And let's just put it out there, because frankly, don't all teenagers suffer from dementia.
She's not a teenager,
but she
thinks I've got it.
But she thinks you've got it. You think she's got it. And Greg, let's just go ahead. Let's put this out there right now. Everybody who has any memory lapse, or certainly I am concerned about Rick. He may actually be concerned falsely about me. I don't know. But
who are you?
Yeah. The jokes just come rolling out of this show about that. But honestly, do you see people who are concerned and you go, no, I don't think you've got a problem here? And what are the things that tell you, no, I don't think you've got a problem? Or is that pretty much anyone who has a memory problem should be concerned about it?
You know, I think that memory problems are always concerning, and we're working through this in terms of what is the cutoff. But really, for everybody individually, different memory problems or different extensive memory problems can have a greater impact in your life. I think what's most important, Tony, is the recognition as to whether or not this is kind of the way you've always been. So in the college world, we see the absent-minded professor who's been that way since he was a teenager, he or she. And that is not something that's worrisome because it's static. It's not changing. It's when people begin to develop trouble with things that they did with ease just a year or two or 5 years before. Now, we actually see the opposite in teenagers, and I agree as the father of teenage children, that sometimes I scratch my head and say, boy, is there a problem here? But they go in the other direction. They start with a memory problem, and it gets better over time.
Right. You probably, as a neurologist, you've had all your kids scanned, right? I mean, you've run the blood test you just to be sure, because some teenage behavior really just does merit at least a consultation.
I like that explanation, though. They start with a problem, and they get better.
Back to finish our sponsor, since we got kind of derailed. 1 in 3 seniors dies with Alzheimer's disease. That's number 7. Number 8, 2/3 of Americans with Alzheimer's are women. Now, it may simply be that women survive stupidity better than men do. You know,
or everybody thinks men have memory problems.
Yeah.
Like my daughter.
But men don't make it to old age. There's a bunch of different ideas on this.
Absolutely. That's the case. And the studies go back and forth. We try to control for the fact that women live longer than men, and age is one of the number one risk factors for Alzheimer's. So how do we really balance that? Again, several studies have supported the fact that women may be at higher risk via hormonal changes in the postmenopausal period. Other studies have completely refuted that and suggest that we're all at risk for this disease.
Fun fact number 9, people with the disease survive on the average half as long as similarly aged adults without the disease. It is a disease of older people. The survival statistics are not good because they're older people. But in fact, if you have Alzheimer's disease.
And when you say half, you mean from the diagnosis from that point on?
Yes.
So from time of diagnosis, they...
Yeah. Okay. And those numbers, Greg, they are kind of dismal. Again, it is a disease of older people, but single-digit years survival after diagnosis?
Yeah, and I think that that's important for many folks to realize. People don't realize that Alzheimer's, as well as many of the other degenerative disorders that affect the elderly, are currently fatal diseases. We don't have cures for them. they will eventually rob someone of their lives prematurely, and that's a big problem. That's part of the impetus for all the work that we're doing trying to find cures for these diseases. We are really talking single digits.
Is this because of the neurology? I mean, is it, I guess I'm trying to make sure everybody understands the reason why a memory problem, something that's classically looked at as a memory problem, leads to a fatality.
What do they die of, Rick? Yeah.
So eventually what happens is enough of the brain is destroyed by these plaques and tangles and the loss of nerve cells that essential things that we need to do in our day-in, day-out life are lost. Things like walking, things like feeling hunger and the need to eat. Eventually, patients with Alzheimer's disease, if they don't die of another medical illness, eventually become bedfast, bedbound, and pass from the causes that other folks who become bedbound pass from, bed sores, infections, pneumonias. Eventually, as the brain is destroyed, the body's unable to maintain life.
And fact number 10, and notice I didn't put fun in front of this, in 2012, 15.5 million caregivers provided an estimated 17.5 billion hours of unpaid care. Total value, probably around $216 billion. It does, in addition to taking a productive member out of society, also cripples families and really does destroy relationships. It is a tragedy. That is our sponsor, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease is Alzheimer's disease. Now, just to recap from last time, Greg has a statewide Alzheimer's clinic done through the video system and also at the University of Kentucky there at Sanders Brown, and has received a grant to study risk factors, which are especially prevalent in rural areas. And these are, let's be sure we understand these risk factors. These are the risk factors for heart disease, the diabetes, the high cholesterol, the high blood pressure, the poor diets, the lack of exercise. All of these things seem to, as he explained last time, they not only lead to hardening of the arteries, to strokes, to heart problems, but they also appear to play a role in Alzheimer's disease. The best diet for Alzheimer's disease is, in fact, the good diet for your heart and your circulation. And exercise turns out to lower your risk about as much as anything else you can do for Alzheimer's disease. That's grant number one. Now, Greg is a prolific researcher, and the second grant really interested me. And Greg, so pick it up there. What else are you looking at now with Alzheimer's?
So we're looking not just at these risk factors, but we're looking at whether or not we can intervene and change the course of disease. This is incredibly important because we know that we've been able to turn around heart disease, and the mortality rates are actually decreasing steadily year after year with what we've learned. And yet, when we look at the morbidity and mortality statistics that are published every year by the Centers of Disease Control in Atlanta, we find one disease that universally is skyrocketing, and that is Alzheimer's disease. It's critically important that we begin to implement some strategies here to attack the disease. The national initiatives that are ongoing are looking at not just these risk factors, but the risk factors that all of us carry as we age. And so there is a fundamental transition in the field. We've been testing medicines designed as cures for Alzheimer's disease for many years now and have come darn close. We have medicines that cure the animal models of Alzheimer's disease. The mice that develop plaques and or tangles can be cured. So hooray for the mice. But what we need to do is we need to get those medicines into humans. And we've been moving them into folks who are in the mild to moderate stage of Alzheimer's disease, already with significant brain injury and destruction. And the results have been disappointing and yet extremely fascinating. For the first time ever, these studies are beginning to show that we can change the disease burden in the brain, that we may be able to reduce or even remove the amyloid plaques from the brain and change the rate of nerve cell death. Unfortunately, it's not been enough to stop Alzheimer's at an advanced stage. Nationally and internationally, scientists and medical doctors like myself have been banging our heads together, and we think that some of these medications need to be tested in folks before they develop overt Alzheimer's, before they develop the true clinical signs of memory loss. And we do know that biomarkers, that imaging studies and spinal fluid studies can detect the disease in the brain 10 to 20 years before one actually develops memory problems. This gives us a window to detect those over the age of 65, and that would be 1 in 3 over the age of 65, Tony, that have these positive biomarkers that we believe are on their way to Alzheimer's disease, to intervene in what really is going to be the first large-scale nationwide study in the prevention of Alzheimer's disease. Biological treatment to stop a disease the same way we stopped smallpox, the same way we've battled countless diseases over the years.
Now, let me see. Let's put this back together, Rick. So I'm going to try to take his words and put them into comic book form.
Good luck.
So that I can understand them. First of all, the point of trying to reverse Alzheimer's disease by the time it becomes clinically obvious. This would be like taking a cancer drug, which does kill the cancer, and starting it when the cancer is metastatic.
Right.
You know, yeah, you would kill cancer cells. You could even maybe keep the cancer from growing, but it's metastatic cancer. You're not going to put that genie back in a bottle by any stretch. So getting to it early. But now, Greg, to understand, this is research. You think that you're onto something here that may actually be able to reverse it. That's not certain. The biomarkers you mentioned that might be able to pick it up early. I mean, the first thing I know that everybody in our audience is asking is, well, shouldn't I have these biomarkers right now? What's the first step? Are these people who already have memory problems? Should we just start screening people? Well, should we just send people and start getting biomarkers? And when do we use these things clinically? Or is this still just a research tool and not ready for clinical use?
Those are great questions, Tony. And again, you know, I should back up one of your statements, and that is we do not yet know if these medicines will truly stop Alzheimer's disease, even in the preclinical state. We're working on that. We need to test them. The upcoming trial will be called the A4 trial, anti-amyloid in asymptomatic Alzheimer's, AAAA. That'll be a nationwide trial. You'll hear more about that this fall. In terms of the use of biomarkers in screening, this is hotly debated, and it's largely debated because, as of yet, we have not hit pay dirt with a medicine that would stop the disease. So if we were to diagnose it, what would that do for us? Now, that is an argument that one can go back and forth on. I think we've already touched on some of the risk factors that folks can modify, that they can be proactive with. So things as simple as knowing that you were at risk for Alzheimer's, that you might have these early biomarkers, might really encourage you to be a little bit more proactive with your health, to exercise, to eat better, to really battle these vascular risk factors that we talked about. That in and of itself could have a profound effect on the disease. On the other hand, we're giving someone a diagnosis that we know is fatal and incurable using the biomarkers, and until we have a cure, does that really make sense? Would we do more harm than good in diagnosing folks? I don't have an answer to that, Tony. That's an ethical question for each of us. We do use the biomarkers clinically in folks who are experiencing memory problems that we're uncertain about. So when in particular might they be useful? Well, say we encounter somebody comes into clinic who's 45 years old and is having memory problems, and yeah, it may look like Alzheimer's disease, but there's no family history. So, of course, we scratch our head and think, what do we do here? Do we simply watch, or do we really need a definitive diagnosis? And that would be an ideal use for biomarkers in today's clinical setting. Otherwise, we're largely using them for research to identify folks at risk for disease who may be candidates for some of these upcoming studies as we attempt to prevent the disease process from ever taking hold.
Again, the biomarker is very useful for research. Clinically, if that biomarker is positive, then you say, okay, it's not the other thing. It's not the treatable thing. If that biomarker is negative and you see memory problems, you know that it's something a little bit less usual and continue working. Because I get this all the time. You know, a person says, oh, my father had Alzheimer's at a young age, or at least that's what he may have had that or something else. I'm not sure. And I'm really scared. Should I go ahead and get some blood test, or should I get an x-ray of my head to see if I have Alzheimer's? What you're saying is that doesn't seem to be, in that setting, would not be your usual practice.
No, I would tell someone with that kind of a family history that by virtue of their family history, they're at high risk. They need to be proactive with modifying these risk factors, changing their lifestyles, and whether that test is positive or negative, whether a biomarker were positive or negative, I would still encourage them to do those things. So it would not change treatment in the least at this point. Now, the paradigm may change. We talk about things like cancer that you mentioned, and we do have some examples of how to effectively treat chronic, devastating, fatal diseases. Breast cancer, for instance, we screen with mammography because we have treatments that can cure the disease, prevent it from ever taking hold or destroying one's life if caught early enough. Hopefully in the future, these biomarkers will serve that same purpose. They'll be mammography for the brain, for all intents and purposes, detecting Alzheimer's so we can move in when we find medicines that truly stop the disease process in humans. We'll have this under control and an ability to use those biomarkers in a responsible way.
Now, I think it's a good time to point out that Richard Criscio at the University of Kentucky, the study reported that we actually have talked about on this show before, Rick. He found that people who reported a change in their memory or thinking abilities since their last doctor visit were twice as likely to be diagnosed with dementia or mild cognitive impairment about 6 to 9 years later. So if you notice in yourself or in a loved one memory changes that disrupt your daily life, new challenges in solving problems, difficulty in completing familiar tasks, confusion with time or place, trouble with visual images, all these things are a reason to seek medical attention. Not necessarily for biomarkers, but to look at all other aspects of your health and to make sure there's nothing else contributing. Medication, perhaps vitamin abnormalities, perhaps hormonal abnormalities, physical impairment, high blood pressure, things like that is a great time to visit the doctor. But again, we're not looking at biomarkers. Meanwhile, from a research standpoint, Greg is vitally interested in picking up those early cases and looking to see if we may in fact be able to do better. And I would encourage those who have someone they love that they're worried about to avail themselves of the resources of Sanders Brown, because that is the state-of-the-art place to get the best care for dementia, I think, anywhere. We've got a lot more to talk about dementia and about Greg's work and also about risk factors for dementia, but once again, we're running out of time. Would you please grab another carrot?
Remember to listen to the third fractional portion.
That's right. And please, please, come back for our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. We're glad you remembered to tune in to the third fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Dr. Dementia Show that is named after our guest, my hero.
See, when I first saw that, I thought they were naming it after you. I thought you were going to have a show devoted to yourself.
No, were you around for the old Dr. Demento shows?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, I am that old, Tony.
Well, this was a regular Saturday night thing with me back when I was in college. I thought that was the best thing ever. But this is maybe not the best thing ever, but pretty darn good thing, because we have a guest here from the University of Kentucky, the Department of Neurology, and also the Sanders Brown Center on Aging, Dr. Greg Jaka. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Tony.
Our sponsor for the last time, the Disease of the Month Club, this month's disease, Alzheimer's disease. And our top 10 fun facts very quickly. It is more than 100 years old, initially identified by Dr. Aloysius Alzheimer, who noted the characteristic amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles in the brain of a woman who died of Alzheimer's disease. Fun fact number two, the sixth leading cause of death in America, more than 5 million Americans affected. Number three, Kentucky has 80,000 people with Alzheimer's disease in 2010. Number four, 1 in 8 people age 65 and older have it, and nearly half the people over age 85 have Alzheimer's disease. It is a very age-dependent disease. Number five, the number of cases of Alzheimer's disease doubles every 5 years in people over 65. Number six, it is exceptional. As Greg mentioned, it can occur in young people, particularly if there is a heavy family history, but it is exceptional for it to occur in people before age 60. 4% of those with Alzheimer's disease are under age 65. Fun fact number seven, 1 in 3 seniors dies with it. Fun fact number eight, almost 2/3 of Americans with Alzheimer's are women. Reasons speculated but not known. Number nine, people with the disease survive half as long as those without it. And number 10, 15.5 million caregivers, 17.5 billion hours of unpaid care taking care of those with Alzheimer's disease. Now, when we left our last fractional portion, we were talking about the importance of looking at seeking medical attention early when you see a change in your cognitive function, your ability to solve problems. You forget where you are, how to get back home from where you are. You become disoriented. What day is it? Now, first of all, if I'm on vacation, I am completely disoriented at all times. And my wife will tell you, I never know what time it is because I miss all kinds of things. We are talking about the point where you cannot reorient yourself. I do not know how to get home from here, even though I drive through here every day. I just can't figure that out. These type of things happen. It is definitely time. Now, Greg, I know, again, fitting with what you were talking about, if that happens in your mind, it's really a little late.
You know, I think that it's never too late, Tony. It's never too late to be proactive, to fight for your brain's health. But certainly, the earlier we clue into these kinds of memory and thinking problems or change, the more effective any of our interventions will be. We've seen that consistently over and over again in the animal studies, and there's very good human data to suggest, again, earlier detection and proactive intervention, modification of lifestyle and risk factors can make a positive difference.
There was a report in the British Medical Journal on September 9th, and this actually said, well, look, maybe we are screening too much for dementia. The diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment, that it may not progress to dementia. Impairment in 40% or 70% of patients does not progress or it improves. So why are we doing this? Pew Research Center, a Pew poll, found that 40% of Americans age 85 or older say they experience memory loss, 27% of those in their 70s, and 20% in their 60s. So, Greg, again, screening 27, 40% of Americans is going to be a lot of people. And is mild cognitive impairment, first, what is it, and are we maybe screening too much?
Two great questions there. Screening certainly can be of use in many disease states. I'm a believer in at least some sort of screen, at least that primary care docs should be addressing the issue of memory change in patients. And that is supported by the CMS, the Center for Medicare Services, as part of your annual health wellness evaluation. Your doctor should at least be asking you about memory and thinking and evaluating it whatever sort of way they deem fit. The issue of mild cognitive impairment as a diagnosis is very complex, and this is a diagnosis that was developed years ago really to identify folks at risk for the development of Alzheimer's disease. And the criteria really is, boils down to several items. Is there a memory or thinking problem, number one? Number two, does this represent a change from past level of performance? Number three, have we eliminated all other treatable medical causes for memory decline? Things like vitamin deficiencies, thyroid problems, perhaps mini strokes, or other causes of that nature. When we get through all of those criteria and we find someone is still left with memory and thinking problems, then we suspect that they are at high risk. Now, most of the American studies that have been done actually suggest that the risk is quite high. If a thorough job has been done looking at someone who's experiencing memory change, no other medical causes are found, the likelihood that they will go on to develop further memory and thinking problems is in the 80 to 90% range, not in the 50s, 60s, 70s that some other studies promote. The difference really is, Tony, in many of these studies, they haven't evaluated effectively for medical causes. We looked at this, actually, in hundreds of folks here in Kentucky who are part of our research program. 160 of those folks went on to develop memory and thinking problems over a short few-year period. And we bring everyone in and do a thorough evaluation. When we were done with that, we actually found that the diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment, when applied fully, is quite high, about a 98% certainty that one was not going to stay the same or revert back to normal, but that one actually was going to go on to develop further memory and thinking problems unless we began to intervene. This is incredibly important because many studies that are out there are only asking people if they have a memory problem, testing their memory and thinking at a single time point, saying, well, yeah, it looks like there could be a mild problem here, and then applying a label to someone that may be really describing the way that they've been all their life, the absent-minded professor, or how your wife might describe you, Tony.
Yeah. Well,
we can't go there.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's, yeah. That is not to
that's
be aired on a public radio station. But again, just to stress this, there is the research JICA. The research JICA says, I want to get people who are normal and study how to protect that normality. That's the research JICA. The clinical JICA is saying, though, that if you see a change in the thought process of yourself or a loved one, it really pays to get evaluated at some level. And again, we're not talking about some new test, a blood test for Alzheimer's or an X-ray, but simply to get a good, solid medical evaluation and look for other treatable causes.
But now, Tony, isn't that just in general? I mean, let's step away for just a second. Isn't that just good advice for the human body? I mean, when you notice there's a change in something that's your body and you know your family's, you know how things are going. If you notice a change, something is probably going on.
Thanks for that, Rick. I can't tell you how many people, after 50 years, and again, people our age have accumulated a wealth of experiences. They have seen a range of human conditions. And then something happens that they have not seen in half a century. It is different from anything that they have seen in themselves or their family, and then they just ignore it. Like,
chest pain.
Yeah. And memory loss is the same thing. If you have not done this and you've not seen this in yourself, your family, your friends, your neighbors, anyone, and it is different from anything that you've seen before, should be universally checked out.
Yeah. For me, it's the same except for one mild exception, and that's my eyesight. I finally hit that point where the eyesight starts deteriorating.
Right. And you see that and you know that that's a point.
Right.
Everybody does that. So you can look around. You can norm yourself by just asking all your friends, does this happen? Talk to your, if you have any friends, that's one of the problems I have is nobody to talk to. Anyway, that's a separate,
we'll have another show for that. Okay.
But let's stay focused on this a minute here because I tend to wander.
I was focused.
Okay. But I want to talk in the time we've got left a little bit about risk factors. And so we're going to run down these risk factors. And Greg, just give me just a couple of comments on these different risk factors. First of all, there are the big five. This is, I think, agreed that these are the biggest one. First one, age. Absolutely.
Absolutely. This is the biggest risk factor. The older you get, the more alert you should be for any kind of impending memory change.
Risk number two, genetics.
Genetics is a strong risk. We think that it may be responsible for as much as 50 to 60% of the overall risk of Alzheimer's. It's not the whole story, Tony. When we talk about genetics, we're looking at family members that are first-degree relatives, mom, dad, brothers, sisters, sons, or daughters with the disease. If it's a second cousin once removed, don't worry about your genetic risk.
And please, remember people marry. Your stepbrother is not necessarily part of your risk. I mean, there's environmental things, yes. But other than that, so Greg, again, somebody has a family member, a first degree, a father, a mother that had Alzheimer's. How worried is it in general?
You know, that is going to increase someone's risk more than twofold, and that is important. But it's important to know that most of the genetic risk for Alzheimer's is not an absolute determinant, meaning if you carry a gene that places you at risk for Alzheimer's, you may never get Alzheimer's disease, and not carrying the gene does not mean that you won't get Alzheimer's. Only about half of all folks with Alzheimer's carry one of these risk genes, and so we do not recommend genetic testing. It's not going to help us determine whether or not you're destined to get Alzheimer's disease. The only exception would be in somebody, again, who comes down with the disease in their 40s or 50s and has a very strong family history. They may actually have a rare, true genetic form of Alzheimer's disease, and we might pursue that further. We can't change our genes, Tony, but we can modify some of the other risk factors we'll talk about.
I'm disturbed by that because Rick never changes his genes, and now he's got a doctor's excuse. That's just sad.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Risk factor number three out of five, head trauma, concussions, doubles the risk.
Absolutely. And this is something, you know, that's really been at the forefront. You know, the NFL football players have a brain bank nowadays. We're learning about new diseases related to head trauma. But Alzheimer's in and of itself, your risk is increased with head trauma. Looking back to my childhood, we never wore helmets when we rode bikes. But I can tell you this, my children wear a helmet when they hop on their skateboard, scooter, or bike. I'm protecting their brains.
And number four out of five, diabetes, especially the adult form, the type 2 diabetes, twice as likely to develop Alzheimer's.
That's right. And there's a lot going on in the field looking at diabetic strategies to reduce Alzheimer's risk. There'll be a large national trial starting this fall as well, Tony, looking at intranasal insulin for the treatment of Alzheimer's, following up on this risk. Manage your diabetes. If your blood glucose is running in the normal range, you have eliminated that risk. It is not an absolute.
And again, the fifth risk factor, the fifth major risk factor, the one that Greg will be working on in coming years with his grant, the risk factors for cardiovascular disease. 80% of people with Alzheimer's have cardiovascular disease. Cholesterol drives the production of beta amyloid, and risk factors for heart disease apply to Alzheimer's as well.
Absolutely. We've got to control these. Again, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, these are risk factors for Alzheimer's disease, but they become negated. They're no longer a risk if they're well controlled. So it doesn't matter whether you have high blood pressure, if it's being treated and it's at normal values, you have just done your brain a wealth of good. You've eliminated that risk factor.
Now, let me ask you, I've seen reports on this diabetic drug or this blood pressure drug being the best at lowering rates of Alzheimer's. Is that because they're effective at treating diabetes or blood pressure, or do you think that the choice of medicine makes a difference outside of the control of the disease?
You know, scientifically, there are great hypotheses as to why one would be better than the other, but really, the studies that have looked at this across the board have basically suggested it's control of the risk factor, not the exact medication that's used. We have no recommendations as of yet for any specific medications. The only recommendation is get those risk factors under control.
Things that help, lifelong learning and social engagement.
Absolutely. We know that a socially isolated environment is going to more than double your risk for Alzheimer's, and a socially active environment, just a few hours a week of regular social engagement, will cut your risk for Alzheimer's disease in half. This is incredibly important. As we get older, social isolation is a major problem that we face. Our friends move away to be closer to family. Some pass. We need to find new ways to increase our social circles and stay engaged. This requires some effort, but brain health may not always come easy.
Join a book club, learn to play bridge, join a choir or a community orchestra, go to church, find some way to be socially interactive. Wine drinking drops risk by 80%. Do you ever advocate drinking wine to prevent?
Yeah, so there is something called the French paradox, Tony. And the paradox is that excessive drinking, we know, is bad for the body, is bad for the brain. But the paradox is that one a day seems to lower risk. Now, we're not talking one 16-ounce tumbler full of wine. We're talking about one glass. And that risk, much like the medicines that you commented on, does not appear, that risk reduction does not appear to be isolated to wine. It is one alcoholic beverage per day that's really been studied in the French paradox. So if you're a bourbon fan, yes, a jigger of bourbon is fine. Keep it down to that one a day and take advantage of that paradox for your brain health.
August Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, bad dental hygiene may be linked to an increased risk.
This chronic inflammation that's set up by some of the periodontal bacteria in the mouth seems to directly affect the brain itself, and inflammation plays a critical role in Alzheimer's disease. There are several studies I published with the School of Dentistry just 2 years ago or so, a similar study, and our findings were almost identical, Tony. That folks at risk for Alzheimer's disease have a high burden of oral dental bacteria, and so seeing your dentist regularly may help prevent Alzheimer's disease.
You know, Rick, this is one of the most frustrating radio shows because I still have tons of questions. We've not even scratched the surface.
Can't we just put "to be continued" on the bottom?
We will have
Can't
to get
that?
Him back. I'd really like to thank my hero, our guest, Dr. Greg Jaika, professor of neurology and also at the UK Sanders Brown Center on Aging. Rick, can you get us out of here?
Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Asa Hosoda and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for Health Matters Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters now comes in convenient XR format for once weekly dosing. Health Matters should be swallowed whole, not divided or crushed.
Remember, it takes time for our show to begin working. After listening to our show, symptoms will either progress more slowly, remain the same, or show some improvement over a period of time.
If the person you care for has forgotten to listen to our show for several weeks, do not turn on your radio until you have talked to the healthcare provider. If you are having a hard time getting your loved one to listen to Health Matters, ask your healthcare provider for advice.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Be out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for our exciting series on the health benefits of procrastination on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.